Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Rogue Angel by Alex Archer. Rogue Angel number 26, The Dragon's Mark. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Colleen Delaney, Yasmin Twazon, Eric Messner, Richard Rowan, Michael Glenn, Terrence Aselford, Christopher Sheeran, Margie Tomprose, Tony Nam, Thomas Penny, James Lewis, Tom Simpson, Dan Stevens, Ken Jackson, and Mort Shelby.
Ise Province, Japan, 1603. Sengo Muramasa stormed about the room in a fit of rage. The furnishings around him bore silent witness to the strength of his anger. The black lacquer tea table had been smashed repeatedly against the floor until it shattered into pieces. The tatami mats had been ripped to shreds with his bare hands. The paintings on the walls had been torn down and stomped upon until the images they bore were unrecognizable. When one of his servants unwittingly entered the room, Muramasa had beat him to within an inch of his life and left him lying unconscious in one corner of the room. The old swordsmith barely noticed the injured boy. His thoughts were on the demands contained in the edict that had arrived earlier that morning. He still couldn't believe it. That bastard Tokugawa Ieyasu had actually gone through with it. The words of the edict echoed around and around in his head.
All weapons crafted by the swordsmith Muramasa have been deemed illegal and banned from use by direct order from the shogun. Carrying such a weapon is now considered a crime and is punishable by death. Anyone caught possessing, hoarding, or transporting a weapon fashioned by Muramasa faces the same penalty.
He could not let this happen. Deny his art? Banish his work? Never. Already the germ of a plan was beginning to form in the back of his mind, and he gave it free rein to grow and expand. He had no doubt the shogun's men would be coming for him, to take his inventory and destroy his forge, to prevent him from creating any new blades. But with winter swiftly approaching, the mountain passes would soon be blocked, and it would take months for them to thaw enough to be passable again. Months he could put to good use. He had just enough time to produce one final sword, the culmination of his career. He would create a sword to be feared and held in awe in equal measure, a blade to master all other blades, one that would strike terror in the hearts of those against whom it was drawn. He would call it Juuchi Yosamu, 10,000 Cold Nights. Ignoring the destruction behind him, Muramasa stalked out of the house and across the courtyard to his workshop. Entering the forge, he paused a moment to say a prayer at the small Shinto shrine in the corner. The forge was a sacred place, and to deny the gods their due would only ensure that his blade would come out weak and brittle. He took the time to ask for blessings and to make the proper offering. When he was finished, he rose and got to work. Muramasa had been preparing to produce a blade for a customer, and so his smelting furnace had already been built. His apprentices had created a thick layer of ash and charcoal as a base, and then had surrounded it with carefully made bricks of local clay, until they had a structure that was roughly 3 feet high, with walls nearly 1 foot thick. they were ready to begin the smelting process.
All of you, come forward. We begin.
The master swordsmith's apprentices came running, eager to begin. Word of the master's fall from favor had already passed through the household, and, as keen as he was to stand in defiance of the shogun's order, they took to their tasks with all of the energy and attention at their disposal. For the next 3 days, they stoked the fire, ensuring that it burned at a steady temperature of 1,500 degrees. Shovels of iron sand were fed into the mouth of the furnace every 30 minutes, the iron mixing with the carbon and charcoal already in the smelter to create a unique kind of steel. Muramasa watched over the proceedings with an eagle eye, carefully monitoring the molten slag that was vented through the holes at the bottom of the furnace, waiting for just the right consistency and color.
Quick, tear down the walls of the furnace!
His apprentices did as they were told, revealing a large mass of molten steel in the center, known as the Kera. Roughly 6 feet long by 1 foot wide and weighing nearly 2 tons, the Kera was carefully moved by rolling it atop a series of logs to the other side of the workshop, where it would be allowed to cool. Once it had, his apprentices would break up the massive block into fist-sized fragments that he would personally scrutinize, searching for those that shone with a silvery brightness from the outer edge. The selected pieces would then be hammered flat by his workers, coated with a thin mixture of clay and charcoal to prevent oxidation, and then reheated to 1,300 degrees to melt them all together into a single block. After that, he would begin the process of forming the blade, hammering the steel and folding it over again and again and again, making the steel uniform throughout. Eventually, he would combine the softer, more flexible core with an outer edge of harder steel, then heat the blade all over again to melt the two layers into one. Later would come the grinding and polishing. For now, however, it was enough that he had begun. It was finished. Muramasa stared at the highly polished blade and could almost feel it watching him. For 3 months, he had poured his soul into its creation. It was imbued with all the hatred, anger, and desire for vengeance he felt toward the shogun. It had a spirit and personality of its own, one that would devour any weapon that dared to stand against it, like the dragon for which it had been named. It was the culmination of his life's work. The door to his workshop burst open and a servant rushed in. Muramasa recognized him as one of those who had been tasked with keeping an eye on the pass in the mountains above. The boy's face was ruddy from the cold, and a long gash ran across his brow.
The shogun's troops!
Enough!
That was all that was necessary. The spring thaw had come early, and Muramasa had been expecting word of their arrival for days. It wouldn't take them long to negotiate the pass and descend down to the valley floor. He had 1 hour, 2 at the most, but it would be enough. Juuchi Yosamu was finished. All he needed was to see to its delivery. After that, let them come.
Quickly! Find me Yukasawi.
Hi!
The boy turned and rushed out the door, intent on doing what his master commanded. While he waited for his man, Muramasa crossed the room and selected a worn and battered saya from a barrel in the corner of the room. He lifted the blade, intent on securing it safely inside the scabbard. As he did so, the weapon seemed to twist in his hands of its own accord. And he felt the sting of its bite as the razor edge sliced cleanly along the underside of his forearm. Blood dripped onto the floor and gleamed wetly against the edge of the blade. But rather than being angry, Muramasa simply smiled. The sword hungered for blood. Who better than to provide its first taste than the man who had fashioned it? Muramasa turned and saw Yukasawi enter the workshop. Muramasa took a moment to study him. The man was a ronin, one of those samurai from the lesser houses who had recently lost his station when his master had gone down in defeat at the hands of the shogun.
This is a man who has almost as much reason to hate Tokugawa as I do. It is for this reason that I have selected him. If anyone can get the weapon to safety, Yukasawi can.
It would be the soldier's job to take the sword out of the mountains, past the shogun's troops, and into the hands of the samurai in Kyoto Muromasa had selected to receive it. The man in question, Ishikawa Toshi, was ruthless and wanted nothing more than to ascend to the position of shogun. He was already amassing his army against Tokugawa and his allies, and Muromasa was confident that his gift would be put to good use in the future. All the swordsmith had to do was get it to him.
Is it time?
The shogun's troops have been sighted at the top of the pass. They will be here shortly.
Then there is still time. If we leave now, we can...
No! There is no time left for running. Nor will I give that dog Tokugawa the satisfaction. By remaining behind, I will delay them long enough to allow you to escape and deliver Jiuchi Osamu as we discussed. On your honor and your life, do not fail me.
Aye.
Taking the weapon in hand, the ronin bowed low, then rushed out of the workshop to where his horse was waiting. The trip down the mountain would be hazardous, but Muromasa was confident his man could handle the task. His other creations might be rounded up and destroyed, but in the depths of his heart, he knew that this one would survive. As his blood continued to drip onto the floor beneath his feet, the swordsmith knew that the world would not soon forget the savage bite of a Muromasa blade. His legacy would live on, and Jiuchi Osamu would devour the hearts of his enemies. Muromasa knew that the shogun's troops were near. It was time to meet death. The old man reached out and picked up a sword. He gave it a few experimental swings, getting the feel for this particular blade, and then turned toward the door with a spring in his step that he hadn't felt for years. The battle had been short, but brutal. His men had fought well, and the snow was stained crimson with their blood and the blood of their foes. Of the 38 men who had remained behind to face the shogun's troops, only Muromasa himself still lived. He had intended to die with a sword in his hands, but apparently the shogun had ordered otherwise. His men had surrounded the swordsmith and attempted to overwhelm him, a move that had cost 10 of them their lives before the older man had been beaten into unconsciousness. Now, with his hands bound behind his back, Muromasa stood before his enemies and waited for the end. The captain of the shogun's troops had been apologetic. This was no way for a man of Muromasa's stature to die, he'd said. But he had his orders, and if he did not carry them out as intended, his own life would be forfeit. Muromasa understood.
Do as you must.
It didn't matter. The resistance, the pronouncement of the verdict against him, the execution to come, none of it mattered, really. It was all stage dressing anyway. A deliberate attempt to get the shogun's men to focus their attention on what was going on around them, rather than searching the countryside for those who might have gotten away. Every hour he delayed them meant another hour that Yukasawi could use to get over the mountains and escape with his precious cargo. Muromasa had given him as much time as he could. Two soldiers approached. They each took an arm and led him forward to the clearing in the center of the compound, where what was left of his household staff were assembled as witnesses in front of the massed arrangement of the shogun's troops. As they drew closer, Muromasa shook off the guards and walked forward on his own. He was not afraid to meet death, and he would not go forward to face it looking as if he did not have the courage to do so on his own. The captain he'd spoken to earlier was waiting for him, naked steel in hand. Muromasa had requested that he be allowed to commit seppuku, but apparently even that last honor was to be denied him. So be it, he thought. He would still have the last laugh. Without waiting to be told, Muromasa knelt in the snow at the captain's feet.
Do not worry. I will make certain that the blade strikes deep. There will be no need for a second blow.
Muromasa bowed his head, exposing his neck. He ignored the long recital of his supposed crimes and the pronouncement of his sentence. Death. He'd heard it all before. As he waited for that final blow, something caught his eye in the distance. He raised his head slightly, just enough so that he could lift his gaze toward the mountain slopes in the distance. On the side of the mountain, where the trail led to the pass that was used to exit the valley and travel to the world outside, a dark speck moved against the snow. It was barely visible at this distance, and had Muramasa not turned his head at precisely the right moment, he might never have seen it. But he had. Yukasawi had made it. He had managed to work his way past the blockade of the shogun's troops and climb the mountain to the pass high above. From there, it would be easy for the Ronin to lose himself in the open country on the other side while he made the journey to Kyoto and delivered the blade. And with that delivery, Muramasa's revenge would begin. Suddenly filled with satisfaction, Muramasa barely noticed as the captain of the guard brought his sword high above his head.
I curse you with 10,000 cold nights.
A smile crossed the old man's face. Fatigued after her long workday, Anya Creed carried several bags of groceries up the stairs to her Brooklyn loft.
Hang on.
She juggled the bags, managed to get the key in the lock, and kicked the door open.
I'm coming, just hang on.
She rushed to the island in the kitchen, dropped the bags on the counter, and grabbed for her phone from the front pocket of her jeans.
You have got to be kidding. Hello?
Anya, did I catch you at a bad time?
What do you want, Garin?
Now, is that any way to treat an old friend?
Old, yes. Friend, that remains to be seen.
You wound me, Anya. You really do.
Anya kicked off her shoes, wandered into the living room, and dropped onto the couch.
Ugh, so be wounded. Then when you've finished feeling sorry for yourself, maybe you could tell me what you want.
I am calling to invite you to Paris.
What for?
Can't I just invite you to Paris?
You could, but you know I wouldn't come, so what's the real reason?
It's the old man's birthday.
It's Rue's birthday?
I just said that, didn't I?
You're going to throw Rue a birthday party?
God damn it, you sullen little bitch! Shit! You always have to be so skeptical. Damn you! I don't care whether you attend or not.
Okay, I'm in. When is it?
3 days from today, the 13th.
Nothing like giving a girl time to think it over.
What? Like you've got something else on your social calendar? I have tickets reserved in your name on the 9 p.m. flight out of Kennedy on the 12th. My driver will pick you up at De Gaulle, take you to Rue's for the party, and drive you back to your hotel afterward.
Garin? Garin? Oh.
Hanging up the phone, Anya went back to putting away the groceries. While doing so, she glanced at her calendar. The bare white spaces stared back at her. The party was on the 13th. On the 16th, she was due in studio to shoot some green screen work for her next episode of Chasing History's Monsters and to wade through the piles of footage she'd brought back from her last trip. Both would be necessary to cut the raw material into a show worth watching, and while she knew the guys in the editing room could do it without her, she preferred to keep an eye on them to help tone down the inevitable suggestions her producer, Doug Morrell, was constantly trying to fill their ears with. So she'd make the party, but she had to be sure to be back in New York by the 16th, come hell or high water. Dressed as she was in a pair of jeans, leather boots, and a lightweight tank top, Anya knew she'd probably make quite a sight rushing helter-skelter through the airport with her long hair flying out behind her, but it just couldn't be helped. She'd gotten absorbed in research and hadn't left herself enough time. If she didn't make it to the gate on time, Garin would never let her forget it. As was her usual luck, after convincing her cab driver to set new land speed records in making it to the airport, and then dashing through the terminal after clearing security, she reached the gate only to discover that her flight had been delayed due to a mechanical problem. At least the ticket was for first class, which let her pass the time in the executive lounge while she waited. Once she did board the plane almost an hour later, she popped on her iPod, stretched out, and slept through most of the trip, determined to arrive ready to enjoy Rue's party. Garin had a driver and car waiting, just as he'd said he would, and as she relaxed in the back seat and she watched the Paris streets roll by out her window, she had to admit that the whole thing made her feel a bit special. Until she remembered just who was waiting for her on the other end. It's for Rue, she reminded herself, for Rue. The party they were throwing for Rue was, of course, a surprise. Or rather, Garin was throwing the party, with Anya and Henshaw, Rue's butler and majordomo, as the only guests. It pained Anya to think that after such a long life, they were the only people Rue could claim as friends, but she didn't consider it too deeply, lest she see the glaring similarities with her own life. That the party was all Garin's idea was equally unusual, given the history between the two men. On any given day, they could go from friends to enemies in the space of a heartbeat. Still, there was a bond between them that transcended such petty squabbles, and as fate would have it, Anya had become part of their inner circle. Anya wondered exactly how old Rue was by now. Must be more than 500 years old, if the truth were told. Garin himself wasn't that far behind, for only a few decades separated the two men. The same mystical force that had preserved the sword of Joan of Arc, the sword that Anya now carried as her own, had also given the two of them an extended lifetime, one measured in centuries rather than decades. The celebration was being held at Rue's estate outside of Paris, and it took them about half an hour to reach their destination. Rue's house was huge, so huge that the word home just didn't seem to do it justice. Palace might have been better. Ivy clung to the stone walls and helped the structure blend into the trees that surrounded it. It butted up against a hill, and the overall effect was as if the house itself were a part of the natural environment around it. And from past experience, Anya knew that the design was deliberate. Rue was a man who liked his privacy and went to some lengths to see that it remained protected. The driver must have called ahead, as Garin was waiting for her on the front steps when they pulled up. Standing with him was Henshaw.
Welcome back, Miss Creed.
Good to see you. Hello, Garin.
Anya.
With her ever-present backpack slung over her shoulder, Anya entered the house with Garin while Henshaw got her overnight bag from the trunk. Anya stepped into the foyer, with its vaulted ceiling and Italian marble floors. No matter how many times she visited, it never ceased to amaze her at the luxury Rue had surrounded himself with over the years. Garin led her through the lower floor to Rue's personal study, one of the largest rooms in the entire house. It was two stories tall and stuffed to the gills with shelves full of books, artifacts, and artwork. Stacks of paper streamers rested on a nearby table, along with a pile of balloons. A tank of helium stood beside it.
Rue is out at a high-stakes poker game for the afternoon. Henshaw will be picking him up around dinner time, which means we only have a couple of hours to get the place decorated and... What?
I'm sorry, Garin, really I am. But I just never expected you to go to so much trouble for Rue, and the change is a bit, unexpected. Nice, but unexpected.
Garin accepted her apology with a shrug, and the two of them got to work. By the time Henshaw came in an hour later to check on them, they had finished strewing paper streamers throughout the room, even draping them on the massive stone sarcophagus that occupied one corner, and wrapping them around the stuffed and mounted corpse of an Old West gunfighter that stood in the other, turning him from a cigar store Indian-style display to a blue and yellow mummy. They were getting started on tying the balloons together into bunches. Henshaw gave the room a once-over, his only discernible reaction the slight raising of an eyebrow as he took in the streamer-wrapped gunfighter in the corner.
I'm off to get Mr. Rue. I shall return in approximately 1 hour. We shall dine shortly after that.
Garin had several phone calls to make, so Anya spent the time wandering through Rue's house, looking at the variety of artifacts that he had on display.
While she might not agree with his methods of acquisition, since he had several items that were on current lists of objects either stolen or banned from being removed from their countries of origin, she could appreciate the beauty of the collection itself. She examined a vase that had apparently been discovered in the remains of Knossos, the king's palace on the island of Crete. Pulling her cell phone out of her pocket, she saw that she had a text message from Garin. "They're here," was all it said. She dashed back through the halls, slipping through the main foyer only seconds before Henshaw and Rue entered the house and joined Garin in the study. There they waited for the guest of honor.
Surprise!
Surprise! Ah, traitor. I suppose you're in on this too, then. Henshaw, what are they doing here?
Celebrating your birthday, of course, sir.
Did you think we'd forget?
It is not a question of forgetting. You've never bothered with my birthday before. What's so different this year?
Rue, however, accepted the surprise good-naturedly, and even began to enjoy himself as the evening wore on. They ate together in the dining room down the hall, then returned to the study for drinks and conversation. Garin and Rue had lived so long and seen so much that Anya could listen to them for hours. Rue was entertaining them all with a tale of the time he'd slipped inside a royal palace for a rendezvous with a visiting princess.
Did you hear that?
Henshaw went straight to the computer sitting on a nearby desk and settled into the seat in front of it. He silenced the alarm with the touch of a button and then pressed another. A section of the wall to the left of where he sat split apart as a result, revealing 16 security monitors in four rows of four. Each of them showed a different part of the manor grounds, and on several of them, Anya saw gray shapes racing across the lawn, firing at the hired security force as they came. She turned away from the monitors to see both Rue and Garin waiting impatiently for the vault at the back of the room to finish opening. It was the weapons stored in the vault that her two companions were going for. Garin armed himself with a pair of heavy pistols, while Rue took a rifle for himself and then carried another over to Henshaw.
Hello? Security?
Garin held up a pistol for Anya.
Here, take this.
Security.
Thanks, but I'm already carrying all the weaponry I need.
Security,
suit yourself.
Garin joined the others at the security station where Rue had been trying without much success to reach the head of his security detail on the radio. Henshaw gestured to the escape tunnel at the back of the vault.
If we leave now, sir, there will still be time to get you off the estate.
Anya knew that it led up to the third floor, and from there out onto the slope of the hill against which Rue's mansion had been built. A jeep waited on the road above, ready to take the master of the house to safety at a moment's notice.
Garin?
It's your call, but if I were in your shoes, I'd be a little pissed. After all, it is your birthday.
You're right. This is my home, and I'll be damned if I'm going to run like a rabbit at the first sign of trouble.
They quickly devised a plan that, when it came down to it, was pretty basic. The four of them would take up position inside the foyer and defend the house against anyone who tried to enter. Anya just hoped it would work. They left the study and quickly made their way through the house toward the front entrance. Rue led the way, followed by Henshaw and Garin, with Anya bringing up the rear. They were just passing a wide staircase that led to the second floor when Anya skidded to a halt. The others ran on, but her attention was caught by the landing on the second floor. Her intuition was calling to her, telling her the problem was above her on the second floor rather than out in front where the others were headed.
Quick, come back! I think they're on the second floor!
Receiving no response, she made the decision to check things out on her own. Turning away from the others, Anya charged up the stairs two at a time, calling her sword to her hand as she went. She made it to the top of the staircase without incident. She found herself faced with a long corridor that ran in opposite directions. She knew the area to the right held a series of guest bedrooms. The left side of the hallway held a bathroom, an office, and a small gallery for some of Rue's art. She ignored all of them. The sound had come from the room at the far end of the hall, the one now facing her, and as she moved toward it, she remembered what it was used for, a display room. The room held a portion of the weapons collection Rue had accumulated over the course of his extended lifetime, in this case, swords. The collection contained both working blades and a few museum-quality relics, but nothing that was overly valuable, and certainly not much that could be moved easily on the open market. She raced to the door and flattened herself against the wall beside it. She put her head against the wall, listening, but she couldn't hear anything. She was going to have to do this the hard way.
Gripping her sword in one hand, Anya grabbed the doorknob with the other, and then pulled it open, slipping inside with barely a sound. She'd been right. It was one of the display rooms. Swords lined the walls by the hundreds. Long swords, short swords, broad swords, cutlasses, épées, scimitars. Every make, model, and size, it seemed. But Anya barely noticed the swords on the walls, for her attention was captured by those held in the hands of the intruders facing her. There were six of them. They were dressed in dark, loose-fitting outfits with hoods pulled up right around their heads and ninja masks covering the lower parts of their faces. Five of them stood in a rough semicircle facing the door, swords in hand. The sixth stood behind the first group, watching, and Anya didn't need to be told that this was their leader. No sooner had she taken it all in than three of them were upon her. She moved to meet the lead swordsman. Anya parried his first blow, then jammed an elbow into his face. Anya kept going. The other two had split up. She rushed the one closest to her. Sword met sword as they flew through a flurry of exchanges. From the corner of her eye, Anya could see the other intruder getting ready to make a strike. Her current foe parried her blow, and she kicked him in the gut. Then she swiveled around to smack the intruder on the side of the skull with the flat of her blade. Three down, three to go, she thought. The gunfire from downstairs indicated that Rue and the others had encountered the enemy themselves, but Anya couldn't worry about them right now. The two attackers she now faced rushed her as one. The swords passed harmlessly beneath Anya as she somersaulted over their heads, twisting in midair to land behind them, facing their exposed backs. She slashed the backs of their legs, taking them out of the fight. One more. She whirled, but the other man hadn't moved. He stood watching her, his hands held calmly together behind his back, like an instructor evaluating her performance.
Who are you and what do you want? I'll give you one last...
Her opponent leapt forward, a katana suddenly appearing in his hands. Anya just barely managed to deflect the strike, backpedaling as she did. Where the hell did that sword come from? Her opponent pushed his attack forward, the ferocity and force of his blows driving her backward across the floor. He managed to get the tip of his weapon past her defenses, leaving a minor wound in its wake. In no time at all, she found herself backed into a corner, fighting for her life. She could see several of the fighters she had already dispatched getting back to their feet. Anya's opponent was distracted for the split second she needed to duck his current blow and strike out with her own. Anya's sword spun out of her hands. As soon as the sword struck the ground, it vanished into the other world. But Anya called it to hand once more. Then Garin was looming in the doorway, pistols in hand. Anya dove to the floor. When she looked up again, her attacker was already halfway across the room, headed for an open casement window.
Garin, the window!
Anya's attacker managed to slip through the opening without being hit.
Oh, no, you don't!
She was almost to the window itself when a hand appeared from outside and tossed something dark into the room in front of her. Threw herself to the side.
Oh.
Only the fact that it had been a concussion grenade rather than an explosive one saved her life. Garin rushed to her side.
Anya, are you all right?
She nodded, woozy. Her heart was beating like crazy.
Oh.
Garin helped her into a sitting position.
Yes. Yes, I'm all right.
Anya sent the sword away, and using Garin's arm for support, she pulled herself all the way to her feet and then stood on still wobbling legs. She glanced over at the intruders, or rather, what was left of them. Garin hadn't spared any ammunition, it seemed. Every body was riddled with bullet holes, and blood leaked across the marble floor beneath them.
Did you have to kill them all?
Yes.
But if you had managed to only wound one or two, we might have been able to question them. Learn who they were and why they were here.
Or they might have managed to kill us both.
Garin stepped over to the window and cautiously looked out. But the intruder must have been long gone, for he turned away, shaking his head. At that moment, Rue and Henshaw arrived.
Is everyone all right?
We're fine.
What happened up here?
Anya explained how she'd arrived to find the intruders already in the room, and what had happened after that. She didn't mention her near defeat at the hands of the final swordsman. That was for her and her alone.
Did they say anything? Do anything that gave you some idea what they might have been after?
No.
I don't get it. The assault force at the front of the house seems to have been a diversion. They made no attempt to take the manor itself, and only put up just enough of a fight to keep the security force occupied.
Given what we know at this point, I'd say the whole thing was a diversion to allow this group to enter the house from the back.
A logical assumption, I agree, but why? What was it they were after?
Rue glanced at the weapons decorating the walls, and Anya could see him silently cataloging each one, gauging whether there was something valuable enough among them to warrant such an attempt. By the confused look on his face, she could guess that the answer to that question was a solid no. As the others looked on, Garin squatted next to one of the bodies. Reaching out, he pulled off the dead man's ninja mask and hood, revealing his face. The man was Asian. Somewhere in his 30s or so, was Anya's guess. He was dressed in a dark blue coverall, similar to those worn by special forces units all around the world, with dark combat boots on his feet. A quick check showed that any identifying tags or markings had been stripped from the uniform.
Recognize him?
No, I don't recognize him. Do you?
Anya wasn't the one who dealt in the shadow world of dirty tricks and ruthless competition. Neither Rue nor Henshaw had ever seen the man. With Henshaw's help, Garin lined the bodies up next to one another, and then he began to methodically search them for information while the other three looked on. He stripped them of their masks and pulled back their hoods, gazing at each face as if it might be able to tell him something. He went through their pockets, checked the labels on their clothing, and even looked inside the boots they all wore. Finally, he stood, a disgusted look on his face.
Nothing. They're as clean as a whistle.
Professionals, eh?
Seems to be. Though that doesn't tell us what they were after.
Or whom.
What do you mean, whom?
Seems rather obvious, doesn't it? They slip a group in the back door while the security team is otherwise occupied dealing with the assault out in front. With all of our attention in that direction, the second group would have had the opportunity to move through the house at will. Probably could have ambushed any one of us before we even knew they were there.
Seems you saved the day, Miss Creed.
But that still doesn't tell us what they were after.
Pissed anyone off lately, Rue?
No more than usual. Perhaps they were after someone with a bit less scrupulous business dealings.
And what's that supposed to mean?
Just what I said. You have a far greater capacity for annoying others than I do. Maybe they were here to settle a debt with you.
Oh, I get it. It is your home that is attacked, your security that is penetrated, but suddenly I'm the one to blame.
You're right. It is my home that was attacked, my security that was penetrated. And I suppose it is just a strange coincidence that it happened on the evening that you planned a surprise party for me now, isn't it?
You think I had something to do with this? That I would stoop so low as that? And to try to kill you in your own home?
I certainly wouldn't put it past you, considering...
Stop it, both of you! Given the incredible number of artifacts and pieces of art inside this house, the most reasonable assumption is that this was nothing more than a well-staged robbery. Lucky for us and unlucky for them, they just happened to choose the wrong night.
Both men backed off, but it was clear that no one was happy with the situation. After a few minutes of angry silence, Rue pulled Henshaw aside and spoke to him quietly, occasionally casting glances in Garin's direction. Garin, on the other hand, pretended to ignore him.
If no one objects, I'll return downstairs to the study.
I'll go with you.
It was a good 10 minutes before Rue joined Garin and Anya, which was probably for the best, as it gave both men some time to cool down. Within minutes of Rue's arrival, it was clear that the night was over. What had made the evening enjoyable was gone, and the chances were slim that they would be able to recapture it.
Well, seeing as I have an engagement early tomorrow morning, I must be off. Can I give you a ride back to your hotel, Anya?
No, thank you.
Suit yourself.
Have you called the local authorities or those in Paris? Detectives from the city would probably be better equipped to handle this kind of thing.
Why on earth would I want to do something so counterproductive?
Your estate has been attacked. People have died. How can you not call the police?
We'll deal with this internally, just as we always do.
But...
I said no police, Anya. I don't need incompetent idiots poking around my house, touching my things, when my staff is perfectly capable of handling this on their own.
Henshaw entered the room.
The room's been cleared, sir. The cleaning crew will be in first thing in the morning to scrub the blood off the floor and to patch the bullet holes by the window.
Very good, Henshaw. Thank you.
You can't just destroy evidence like that.
This is my home, Anya. I can do whatever I want in it, including shooting armed intruders foolish enough to enter it. You and your friend Garin would do well to remember that I am not the feeble old man you appear to think I am.
Deciding she'd had her share of 500-year-old egos for the evening, Anya strode through the house and back to the second floor, intending to collect her backpack from the room she'd stored it in and get the heck out of there before she said something she would regret later. But once on the second floor, she felt herself drawn back to the room where she'd come close to losing her life. Anya stood inside the doorway and let her gaze just wander about without focusing on anything in particular. Her thoughts kept returning to those few moments just before the fight, when she'd first entered the room. She could still see them in her mind's eye. The first five men arranged in two precise rows, their swords out and ready, providing the most protection possible for their leader. They had all been standing still, eyes forward, almost as if they had been waiting. But for what? She looked past the bloodstains on the floor and the pile of extra sheets that had been set there in case more were needed to transport the bodies out of the house, and tried to see the place through fresh eyes. She was missing something, and she knew it. There was something here for her to find, something important. But all she could see was row upon row of swords and the fragments of the window scattered across the floor. Finally, frustrated, she turned away, intending to arrange a ride back to her hotel and call it a night. That was when her eye caught something out of place, a slight anomaly in the otherwise orderly arrangement of the collection. There. Standing on the hilt of a broadsword that was remarkably similar to the one that she and Joan shared, was a small figure. When she stepped closer to get a better look, she discovered that it was made from paper. The origami figure was in the shape of a dragon, with swept back wings and a long, winding tail. She stared at it, trying to figure out how it had gotten there. Anya had been around Henshaw enough times to know that he ruled the cleaning staff with an iron hand. None of them would have dared leave something like the origami dragon behind, no matter how innocuous it seemed. The lack of dust on the weapons meant that the display had been cleaned recently, probably in the past day or two. In turn, logic dictated that the paper figurine could only be that old as well. After all, had the cleaning crew found it, they would have thrown it away. It was almost as if it had been purposely left behind, a small token to remind them that someone other than themselves had been here, in this place where no outsider should be. She reached out to pick it up, and then thought better of it, and swiftly withdrew her hand. If it had been left by the intruders, then she needed to take care to preserve whatever evidence might have been left behind. Anya left the display room and walked down the hall to the room where she'd left her backpack. Retrieving her digital camera, she returned to the display room. She half expected the origami dragon to be gone when she got back, but it was still there, right where she left it. She turned on her camera and went to work. She took close-up pictures of the figure from as many angles as possible and then made certain to get some positioning shots as well to illustrate just where on the wall the sword on which it stood was hung. When she was finished, she used a pair of tweezers to lift the paper sculpture off the shelf. Now it was time to do some serious research. Rue had already refused to bring the intrusion to the attention of the Paris police, but that didn't mean that Anya was out of options. Far from it, in fact. From a public payphone in Paris, the call was routed through a number of middlemen and cutouts designed to hide the origin of the contact should anyone be listening in, until it was at last picked up via cell phone in the back of a limousine.
Yes? I didn't hire you to evaluate her abilities. Can you carry out the task we discussed or not? Yes, you are the dragon, but don't be overconfident. She survived far too often when the odds were arrayed against her. You'd do well to remember that. Yes, she's staying at the Four Seasons. Remember, she must give up the sword voluntarily. Anything else will defeat our purposes.